Hello, this is a special message from Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett in Oujda, Morocco, where I lectured on We Are Not Charlie Hebdo yesterday at the Nibraz Institute. It went over very well. The people here in Morocco are very much aware of the kinds of conspiracies and other actions that we talk about on this radio show. So thank you to everybody who has helped keep this radio show going and who has helped me continue to spread the word all over the world. And I'd like to give a special shout out of thanks to the folks who donated to the GoFundMe page that has enabled me to plan on going to the Islamophobia and Civil Society Conference in Paris, France on December 11th and 12th. I can't wait to talk about what Charlie Hebdo truth at this mainstream academic conference where my paper has been accepted, and I can only do that thanks to the generosity of people like you. So thank you so much to everyone who's been helping keep the Truth Jihad alive. And if you haven't yet done anything along those lines, feel free to go to truthjihad.com and make a one-time donation, or better yet, subscribe to the radio show for only $3.95 per month. It's a pretty good radio deal, so check it out. And now, for today's guest. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio Show, the all-out struggle for truth, disguised as a radio show. I'm Kevin Barrett, your host, bringing you great guests talking about the most important topics I can find that are not being adequately discussed elsewhere. As Clausewitz said, war is politics by other means. This show is education by other means. Today, we're going to talk about the sad passing away of a towering intellectual figure who has had a tremendous influence on a certain corner of the world's thought that may expand considerably in the future. At least I think it will. René Girard, the great French, what do we call him? Human scientist, les sciences humaines is what the French call it, anthropology, but what do you call it? It has a spiritual edge. He was a Christian. His great discoveries actually have been thought by some to enhance the allure of Christianity and perhaps religion in general. A very, very interesting man, and here to talk about it is Tom Breidenbach, my favorite literary 9/11 truth figure. He's written some brilliant stuff, including the book of poems 9/11 and The Wicked Child, and he's worked on this amazing territory of 9/11 as a kind of a human sacrifice full of traditional sacrifice symbolism, and that ties into the thought of René Girard, but that's about as far as I can take it by myself. So let's welcome Tom Breidenbach. How are you, Tom?
I'm doing well, Kevin. Thank you. It's nice to be with you again.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. Your work is absolutely amazing. It's a lot of people actually have tried to write a story or in some cases do some poems about 9/11. But I think you've taken it to a whole new level with your book of poems. And I guess you were inspired by none other than the recently deceased anthropologist, or whatever you want to call him, René Girard. Maybe you could introduce the listeners or reintroduce them to Girard and how you got interested.
Sure. I actually learned about Girard by listening to your radio show some years ago.
Well, the show's good for something.
Quite a bit, actually. I'm in your debt for a number of things, and that's included. He became pretty quickly one of my my guiding lights philosophically. And I just started reading everything I could by him. The first thing I read by him was his most famous book, Violence and the Sacred. And I read half of it in a day, and was just so struck by it. And I've never quite had the same experience with any other book in my life. I put it down. I thought I would finish it the next day, and I walked around in a daze for several weeks. I couldn't read anything or write anything. It was truly like having the veil torn away. And it had the force of revelation. And a number of people who read Girard feel this way about him. And Girard himself, I guess people kind of call him a cultural theorist. He wanted to be called an anthropologist, but he felt rejected by the social sciences, though I think prematurely, I think they're coming around. There are two recent volumes that suggest that. He was a towering intellect, and he's 91. He was 91 when he passed on November 4th. So, you know, hopefully we can pay a little bit of tribute to his thought. He's a truly great thinker.
Yeah, one of the things about René Girard that really, you know, has inspired me is that he's one of these people who's, he's not like trying too hard. He's not trying to do anything fancy. He's simply discovered a fairly simple truth, and he is just doggedly pursuing the truth, and it gives him a certain eloquence, and that is, you know, inspires me. 9/11 in a way is a little bit like what Girard discovered, in that it's a very simple truth. It's very obvious. You look at the demolitions of the Trade Center and you look a little bit at the context, and it's just overwhelmingly obvious. And but nobody really wants to deal with it. And the more, you know, fancy the intellect, the more academic games they're playing, the more, you know, the more they're phony, the less they want to deal with it. So I feel a little bit of an inspiration from Girard in taking a simple truth and just doggedly pursuing it. And that actually can give you a certain eloquence. And it certainly gave him an incredible eloquence. You get the sense that kind of just love of truth is kind of what led him to do his life's work?
Yes, very much. He is just so eloquent, and it does come from a place of humility, and his writing is, you know, shows such a genial and witty at times character, even though he's handling deadly serious things and themes. He, you know, these are obvious truths to us in a way. They come to seem that way. I know I battled with 9/11 for 2 years before I finally accepted it. And it does seem obvious in hindsight. But I guess the reason that it doesn't seem so obvious before you get to hindsight is because they're such difficult psychological truths. They say something so terrible about us, potentially, or, you know, the propensities within our own cultures and species. And they're extremely uncomfortable truths. And it's odd that Girard, I mean, he really bridges a lot of gaps, I guess, or he's a study in contradictions in a certain sense. He's a religious man, and yet he's a Darwinist. He's trying to make sense of Darwinian theory and cultural as well as potentially biological evolution. And this just seems, you know, conventionally thought about, these seem incompatible. And when you read Girard, these two visions of the world come to seem like left and right brain visions. And you wouldn't want either of them to be altered. You want science to be able to pursue its ideas, and yet you don't want the traditional religious perspective on humanity, even with the contradictions between these two. They have to kind of be able to both be there for us to have a focus. And I think Girard helps us helps one get that focus.
I agree. And at another level, you mentioned, you know, how painful the truth is about 9/11, and likewise the truth that Girard discovered, that we have these mimetic rivalries. He says that, you know, humans are creatures of what he called mimetic desire, That is, we look at other people and we kind of feel a desire for what they desire. And of course, if you were to sort of map this out mathematically almost, you know, A desires what B desires, what C desires, and, you know, everybody desires what everybody else, what they see everybody else desiring. And of course, this gets totally out of control. It just, you know, and that, the reason I think that's hard for people in a way to come to terms with, it's not just because this leads to human sacrifice, you know, othering people and then ultimately expelling, hating, and killing in a kind of ritual manner. But even just the fact that we go through life wanting, you know, desiring, envying other people is a hard truth to accept. And that it's that virtually everything that we want in life, that, you know, if you're an ordinary person, you're growing up, you want this, you want that, you want to have that, you know, attractive person that somebody else has, you want to have that attractive look that somebody has, you want to have money, you want to have status, you want other people to, you know, respect you and be in a high position in life, and you want a car, whatever it is, you know, these things people go through life desiring are completely phony. They're mirages. We're going through life desiring mirages. We're all completely insane. And this is a tough truth, and we're all phony to ourselves. We're all lying to ourselves all the time, imagining that we're something really much better than we really are. So in a way, just as 9/11 completely unveils the hideous reality of America and power in America and power in general, likewise, I think that Girard's theory unveils a hideous reality of what we are, and it's, you know, I think it's still an open question whether we're going to be able to come to terms with this.
Yes, definitely. You can't read Girard and not look at yourself differently, as well as he makes so much sense of the world and ultimately of one's own innermost thoughts and feelings, and that's, it's really a process of self-examination that you go through in reading him. But, you know, there's another effect, I think, that he's had on me that's maybe been more long-term. When I first started looking at this 9/11 material, I mean, a sense of existential panic hit me, you know, if this is, and I think this is what prevents a lot of people from looking at 9/11 critically. Because if that's true, it instinctually suggests to them, you know, intuitively suggests to them something like what Girard is talking about, that the roots of our culture, this goes so deep, not just into American culture, but into the species itself. You know, it says something so profound about our species itself that's so terrifying. And one thing that Girard's allowed me to do, and I reflect that, you know, Girard, when he was writing Violence in the Sacred, he had a kind of nervous breakdown, if I'm not mistaken in remembering this aspect of his biography. Mm-hmm. And so he's been through this, and this, the writing carries that wisdom, you know, as Aeschylus says in the Oresteia, you know, he suffered into this truth. And there's a lot of suffering in encountering what we have encountered with 9/11, right? When you acknowledge that. And so even though Girard never himself got to 9/11 truth, I mean, he had so many other things on his plate and was, you know, he's 91 when he died. He did encounter this sacrificial basis of, and he articulated the sacrificial basis of human culture. That's a complex term we could unpack a little bit later. But he's allowed me to have a great sympathy for the species, to see the human past in all of its violence and gore, as well as grandeur, and to see the present in light of an extremely violent past. And that has given me a lot more compassion. I think part of the danger that we face in looking at 9/11 is we can lose our own humanity in the terrifying nature of that vision. because it really brings up something that's so threatening. You know, our culture in some sense is at stake in 9/11. And so even talking about it, there's almost, 9/11 itself is a huge betrayal. Talking about it and trying to expose it can also feel like a betrayal. And it suddenly, it disorients us. We don't know which side, you know, just at an instinctual animal level, we don't know which side to take. You know, do we take the powers full side? They must have felt there was something urgent about this. I mean, it's a very instinctual question that I think it poses. Some of us have, maybe grappled with that a little more easily than others of us. But it depends on our backgrounds and how much abuse we've been through in our own lives. And, you know, we live in a culture that is characterized by abusiveness in many ways, a culture of extreme materialism and desire, and, you know, a culture that where rape is much, you know, sexual imagery. So it's allowed, Gerard has just allowed me to have a much more human and humane take on my own culture as well as my own species. And that's one of the great benefits. He's helped, I think, restore my own sanity in the wake of the 9/11 revelation.
Yeah, I could say the same thing, although I probably am coming at it from a slightly different perspective because I came to Islam in 93. Mm-hmm. And kind of, you know, 9/11 happened and the whole country went crazy, and it was obvious that there was a kind of a witch hunt against Muslims that was going on. And my response, of course, was to be completely alienated from that. You know, if it's like there wasn't even the slightest thought in my mind that there could be anything remotely legitimate about the rush to war, you know, the rush to scapegoating Muslims and so on. That was just so obviously bogus and evil that my problem was losing sight of the humanity of the West of Americans, you know, Christians and Jews and every, you know, the people I was living among were looking like zombies. You know, I was living in a, you know, zombie movie or something, where Americans, you know, were basically wandering around like wanting to bite off chunks of my flesh. You know, it kind of felt like that. I was living in a horror movie. And so one natural response to that is to just be so alienated that I lose sight of the humanity of my fellow Westerners, my fellow Americans, and Christians, a Christian religion, which never really worked for me, which is one of the reasons I ended up in Islam was, you know, I don't get the Trinity doesn't make any sense to me. The anthropomorphic patriarchal vision of God, an old guy with a beard, that doesn't work for me. Father, the Son, how could God have a son? This doesn't work for me. I guess maybe I was my Unitarian background. So I already was just, you know, Christianity per se, even though I read the Bible and found it beautiful, the story of Jesus is quite beautiful, but it didn't work for me at all anyway. So I was ready, you know, if there had been such a thing as a real Al-Qaeda, you know, I was always ready to join up, you know. But Gerard helped me recognize the beauty in Christianity and what it's brought to the world culture through Western culture, and to recognize that these people around me who were caught up in this horrific sacrificial witch hunt against me and my people and my family, you know, my kids couldn't go to school because of what would go on in the school bus in the school. I'm living in this nightmare, and getting Gerard's insights really helped fix my vision, save me from becoming, you know, so alienated that I wouldn't be able to live with Americans or Westerners. And then also to recognize that there's something even more deeply and profoundly beautiful about the very aspect of Christianity that Islam rejects, which is the crucifixion and resurrection. Well, we accept the resurrection, but the crucifixion and the idea that, you know, God had to sacrifice his only son in order to save a terminally evil world, this is something that I could never relate to at all. In Islam, of course, the world is perfect because if there's a perfect God, it has to be a perfect world. But Girard's thought helped me see that there is something profoundly beautiful, that there is a reason for Christianity, and that these Christian, you know, this post-Christian Western culture around me was not completely utterly hopeless. The people were not heartless zombies, you know. So it kind of saved me from terminal alienation. And so now I'm living in only partial alienation, thanks to Girard.
Well, I think we all are living in partial alienation, you know. And if we can keep it partial, we're doing a good job, I guess.
Yeah.
And Girard does help in this. He helps to see the there's a common human, you know, our common humanity. Yeah, and I guess another important figure is another René from France, Guinon, who has helped me understand, you know, as a Christian, I look at 9/11 as a blood libel against my Muslim brothers and sisters. And as a being committed to a pursuit of the truth, and that being implied by Christianity, I have to seek to end this blood libel as I would have had to have done during World War II in the blood libel against the Jews that was being spread. And so this just is a matter for me. When I've read René Guinon, who is coming from the Sufi Islamic perspective and writing so brilliantly about the nature of the transcendental unity of all religions, and it's a dangerous doctrine. And you've spoken with about this in past radio shows, and he's another figure though who's very important and points out the commonality between the monotheistic traditions. And he's helped me to understand how we can talk across these boundaries that are the exoteric boundaries of Islam and Christianity and Judaism, et cetera, and the other religions as well. You know, there are many interesting people who are writing from various religious faiths. I've been reading a book by somebody from India who's talking about Girard and Hinduism, but how Hinduism has its own critique of sacrifice. When we look at what we've all come out of and what really in the span of time that we're thought by science to have been here, this axial age in which humanity somehow across the globe began to undergo this cultural shift, apparently away from human sacrifice and toward a compassion for the victim, where we stopped celebrating, so at least so exclusively as the ancient myths do, the hero figure, the human sacrificer, if you will, the one willing to kill, the sacred executioner in Chaim Maccabee's, the scholar Chaim Maccabee's phrase. The sort of figure of Cain or Romulus who kills to establish a culture, right? You see in the story of Cain how in this he's punished. Monotheism has at least a curse attending this guy. You see in the story of Romulus where it's much more vague. The older stories and the older culture appears to have been much more about the victor. Whereas with monotheism, we have the story, the side of the story of the vanquished, the Israelites having been enslaved, etc. So there's this huge, massive cultural shift that really is, comparatively speaking, if we're 150,000 years old as a species, maybe older, maybe our brain has undergone some kind of modification since, maybe it's only, our precise brain structure is only about 50,000 years old, what have you. The axial age occurring within the past 2,500 to 1,500 years is a very recent development. Now, whether we'll survive and to see the fruition of the Axial Age is another entire issue, but it's Girard who helps us see the deep historical past and our kinship to our tribal brothers and sisters who are still living in worlds where things like dark shamanism and forms of human sacrifice are the essential foundation of the entire civilization. And we're only beginning to learn this in works by the late ethnographer and anthropologist Neil Whitehead, whose two volumes, Dark Shamanism, and the one he edited, In Darkness and Secrecy, are essential to seeing this point. It's hard to describe because when you say it, it sounds so crazy. What do you mean cultures are founded on human sacrifice? Ethnographically, anthropologically, you see the figure of the dark shaman has been quote unquote necessary to societies because he kind of chills out the internal rivalries within the societies. And he's looked at as being essential to the power structure of the society, to the social stratification of the society, to politics, if you will, within the society, as well as to things like planting, agriculture or gardening within the society, and where the society establishes a building or builds a hut or something like this. And when you look at our own culture, it appears we have our own dark shaman or sorcerers functioning in the precise same capacities as they do in, say, Amazonia or in Indonesia, tribal societies.
Isn't that amazing? You read Whitehead about these guys who are using is it the Datura-Vine, I think it is, that mind control zombie drug thing, where they, they like mind control people, they capture them and basically enslave them.
That's not Whitehead. That's not Whitehead. That's another figure I forget. I think they're actually using a kind of pufferfish poison.
Okay.
Is that the serpent in the rainbow?
Wesley. I thought Whitehead had seen something like that as well. But in any case, what these dark shamans do that is so similar to what it looks like the MK Ultra did, the CIA mind control program. It's almost like there must be some kind of unbroken line of descent between the two.
Well, it's hard. I have one of my books on the CIA somewhere. It talks about how they actually did study dark shamanism.
There you go.
And, I don't know if it's a line of descent or if it's just from the, Guinan talks about this. If we part from the path, these are just the mechanisms that we revert to almost automatically. They're the only thing that's left to us. If we don't behave in a manner that is compassionate and loving toward each other, there's really only one option. And it's kind of looks fairly mechanical in how it plays out. And this is what Girard paints so beautifully and with his anthropological readings and his literary background. He can just describe it so beautifully, and you just see it playing out on this. You can see it playing out on the street in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I sort of wonder if I haven't delved enough into whether people using Girardian modes of inquiry have looked into Islam, because it does seem to me that in Islam there are these very well-developed sorts of cultural ways of keeping this mimetic desire problem under control. So, for instance, modesty in dress and deportment, giving up the ego, sacrificing the ego five times a day during the prayer, sacrificing the desiring ego, or the nafs al-amara bisu' is the Quranic term for it, during the feast or the fast of Ramadan. While fasting, you really do get detached from your desire. You're not just the desire to eat and drink, but everything just kind of goes away, and you start to get a little sense of what it would be like to be a consciousness without a body, which many metaphysicians say is what's precisely going to happen to us when we die, and we'll enter what would be kind of an eternal dream, except unlike a dream, you don't wake up. So you'd better have a peaceful soul when you do that. And of course, the Tibetan Book of the Dead is a book of guidance for the people who guide the dying into the next world, the barzakh or whatever the term is. So it does seem to me that Islam has this very highly developed means of inculcating peaceful souls, and thereby kind of putting a damper on this problem of rivalry and mimetic desire flaring into out of control rivalry, and then turning into a Hobbesian war of all against all, and then everybody turns against the scapegoat and sacrifices him and restores order, which is what Girard says is how all cultures work. It seems to me Islam has really kind of calmed that down, but then we look at certain places in the world today where, whether it's a result of modernity encroaching or whether it's people coming in and making war on those countries or some combination thereof, you see this kind of sacrificial motif suddenly exploding horrifically, like with these Islamic State beheading videos and stuff. It's all very, very strange and kind of unnerving.
Well, one of the most disturbing things about 9/11 and the post 9/11 world is that it's exacerbating those tendencies. And it's pulling us away. We've spoken about this before. It's pulling us away from the monotheisms and from the monotheism that the three branches of monotheism in their own ways represent. Aguinaud writes about how Judaism is the exoteric. It occurred within such a brutal social milieu that it had to be an exoteric, highly rigidly ritualized culture, because it was facing so much human sacrifice all around it. Well, Christianity, there was such a rigidity within Judaism that Christianity broke out and was almost completely esoteric in its teachings. It's the esoteric truth, if you will, at the heart of Judaism, and that this was so difficult in its own way, because the esoteric points that Christianity makes are, and I'm just going to paraphrase Guinaud, but they're hard to deal with for most people, and they're not apparent, and they can become easily bogged down in dogma and misunderstanding, and that in a way, Islam is the balance between the exoteric and the esoteric in monotheism. And there's something that makes sense to me about that. I am a Christian, and it's my background. It's just what I feel. The West, is confronted in the victimization of Christ, with the tendency, our tendency to victimize innocence. But what you say about Islam balancing these in a traditional way, I think Christianity has had that in its past. I think, again, we're living in a largely post-Christian society, lamentably, in many ways, in an ultimate way, because we're reverting back to human sacrifice as a culture. And 9/11 is just it just screams that symbolically. It's just done with such abject use of these symbolic symbols. It's a symbolic declaration of my, the book I'm working on hypothesizes it marks the end of the Christian. It's intended to mark the end of the Christian dispensation. And wow. It's, I can't think of anything more apocalyptic for the West.
And some people got that without necessarily having deep insight or even being on the right side. I remember Camille Paglia, the famous kind of, what do we call her, the out of control, sexualized deconstructionist, trendy writer, wrote a piece after 9/11, or a book even, I think it was, that said, we're back in paganism and hooray, we're all pagans again, bye-bye Christianity. Isn't it going to be fun to be out there, right, being heroes and killing and not having any moral qualms and all that kind of stuff?
It's just how ill-prepared the left is morally and intellectually for what 9/11 confronts us with, and at least the American left, and I think much of the left in the West.
Oh, yeah, look at Charlie Hebdo. The French are even worse.
So it's just, it's laying down for this slaughter, and it's the traditional point of view is that the answer is not going to come through politics. It's going to come through personal renunciation of, is the Islamic term al-dunya.
Yeah, the dunya is this world as opposed to the
this
next
world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. With the implication of the pleasures and the, you know, sorts of, you know, enjoyments of life in this world that are ultimately pretty fleeting.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, one aspect of Girard's thought that I guess I'm not entirely clear on, maybe you can help me with, is he's very, very insistent on the notion that the victim always has to be innocent. That is, you know, just I'll resume this again for listeners. I'm sure some of our listeners are not, haven't read Girard and might be a little bit lost. So once again, for those listeners, we'll remind them that this real basic template that Girard came up with, this very simple discovery that he made and developed throughout his life, was that because of this problem of mimetic desire, that we desire what other people desire, and this gets out of control and chaos results, lots of rivalry, fights, and boy, we sure see this everywhere. Look around. Look at the 9/11 truth movement. Look at people getting into mimetic rivalries, fighting over what happened at the Pentagon or how the towers were demolished. You know, it's like, it's so obvious. So this leads to things get out of control. And so how do you resolve this? Well, you other somebody. You turn somebody into a demon. You know, let's have a human sacrifice of Jim Fetzer, because he's such an obnoxious guy, and he's wrong about the Pentagon, or he's wrong about the towers demolition, or this or that. So let's expel Jim Fetzer from the 9/11 truth movement. Let's burn him at the stake, right? So this is what Girard says happens all the time, that culture is founded on this process. And then it goes one step further, that you expel, you know, you expel the scapegoat, and then the scapegoat takes on an aura of sanctity over time and becomes kind of an idol or a god. And then he says Christianity puts an end to this, because in Christianity, Jesus was innocent, and the whole religion is based on the fact that he was the underdog, he was innocent, he was perfect, he was pure, and the people who sacrificed him were wrong. Therefore, sacrifice is bad, and let's identify with victims. So this is
right,
kind of...
I'll just add it.
Yeah, because this is...
It turns mythology on its head, whereas mythology was always a way of kind of excusing the human sacrifice or showing how the, you know, if you look at the Pharmakos ritual in ancient Greece, right, where they basically, we don't know for sure, but it looks like once a year they would go and they would probably kill the homeless people or something. The myths talk about it in a way like this, but we can't tell that this happened because it's very difficult to find archaeological evidence. I mean, almost all human skeletons and get decomposed quickly unless they're in very specific circumstances. But yeah, for Girard, scripture kind of turns myth on its head by showing the innocence of the scapegoat. Did you want to add more about that?
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say was that for Girard, it's important, you know, for his system, the scapegoat always has to be innocent. And we certainly see evidence for that. And he does present evidence for that. And of course, in Christianity, that's key to the way Christianity works, is by ending this process of human sacrifice by changing, you know, instead of hiding the fact that the sacrificial victim is innocent and pure and spotless and everything, it accentuates it. But my question is, it's like anthropologically to me, it's not always obvious that all sacrificial scapegoats and victims are in fact completely innocent. In other words, basically, it looks to me like sort of the paradigm of what should we call it? Law enforcement is based on the fact that we're basically going to round up and ritually sacrifice some evildoers, as Bush would say, some malefactors, and that keeps law in order, because people see, if you get out of hand and you start, you know, if you get, you know, so full of mimetic desire that you start stealing other people's stuff or hurting them or killing them to steal their stuff, then there's going to be this big ritual sacrifice where you're dragged in front of a judge and the gavel pounds and you're basically, you know, sacrificed, thrown into jail or whatever. So that's kind of how law enforcement works. And likewise, in a sense, military defense works the same way, that if that other tribe over there messes with us, or if we have some kind of rivalry over the you know, feeding grounds or whatever, you know, the hunting grounds, we're going to they're suddenly the enemy, and we're going to sacrifice them, and killing them becomes a sort of a holy duty of our warriors and so on. So there's all these kinds of sacrifices that happen in these kinds of contexts that we take for granted, but it's not always clear, to me anyway, that the quote-unquote criminals that we sacrifice on a daily basis in huge numbers in every society in the world are all innocent. And likewise, it's not obvious to me that the soldiers of the enemy are not really the enemy.
Yeah, and Gerard, you know, I don't think he would say they're all innocent either. What he says is that, not in that sense. I mean, I think what he's talking about, the innocence of the scapegoat, is shown in the figure of Christ. The thing is what the scapegoat is doing, as Gerard points out, the scapegoat is not so much innocent as random. The scapegoat is just anybody, and the scapegoat's probably doing what everybody else is doing. Mm-hmm. But they just get kind of pointed out and blamed for it, and then there are a lot of people around who are doing that very same thing, who don't get scapegoated. And then that's the kind of, I think that's how Gerard thinks of that. And he's pointing to this part in the past where this would have happened, within communities that were experiencing mimetic rivalry due to the fact that they weren't regulated, their desires weren't regulated. And what religion, which means to bind or to bind back, the etymology, does is it binds or regulates desires. It does this variously within from culture to culture, but it always does this in some sense. So when a culture when desire is unregulated, mimetic desire, that's when you get this conflict and people fight over things and they all want the same things and they begin to kill each other and get in arguments and hold grudges, and this, it builds up to the kind of war of all against all, or, you know, basically two sides usually go to war. It threatens the whole community with destruction, and there's a sacrificial crisis. And then the communities might destroy themselves, but what Gerard hypothesizes is that the communities that survived were able to successfully scapegoat somebody among them who was innocent in this sense. They were doing simply what everybody else was doing, but they were a more convenient victim because their death is less likely to cause a series of reprisals that can bring about the whole sacrificial crisis again. You don't want to kill someone too important for a community. You want to kill a kid, an adolescent, a woman. I mean, this is how it's, when you look in the myths, you know, the virgin Iphigenia, adolescent, she's slain to start the Trojan War, you know. So you see kind of stereotypes and symbols of sacrifice. Children, again, at people who the communities invested less in, foreigners, prisoners. So yeah, the victim is not innocent in that sense, but they're not being killed necessarily for what they're doing. They're being killed as a kind of palliative for the whole society.
Mm-hmm. And in the prophetic tradition of monotheism, often these prophets are truth tellers who tell, you know, who expose the evil, meaning people's kinds of hypocritical desires that, you know, become very bad for other people, you know. And so the prophet exposes all this evil that's in the society. And then, of course, quite often that prophet is likely to become a sacrificial victim or have a brush with being nearly a sacrificial victim himself. And then Jesus, of course, being a culmination of that. But Muhammad, too, in Islam, peace upon him, is also very much in that position, telling the truth about the mimetic rivalries getting out of control in the oligarchy that ruled Mecca at the time, to the point that they were sacrificing their girl babies, and they, you know, hospitality and take care of other people ethic had broken down completely. And so then this Islamic message came and made the people who were following Muhammad scapegoats, and they became, you know, they were sacrificed, they were viciously maltreated. And then, very interestingly, there's this crucial scene right before that, just the moment before the Islamic era begins, when the tribes of Mecca all decide to sacrifice Muhammad. And to do this so that there won't be any reprisals, as you suggested, that's what when they sacrifice somebody, you don't want to start another feud. You need to do it in a way that unites the community, and no, there can't be any revenge by the clansmen of the victim. So what they did was every clan in Mecca sent one guy, and they all had a knife, and they went to Muhammad's house, and they snuck in there. They were just about to kill him when they discovered that it wasn't him, that he had just snuck out of town. And so this is the moment when the Islamic calendar begins. It's called the Hijra, when the Muslim sacrificial victims, or almost sacrificial victims, went from Mecca to exile in Medina. And that's the day that the Islamic calendar begins, is that almost sacrifice of the Prophet Muhammad. So this is a kind of a prophetic motif that we see throughout the whole history of monotheism, into, you know, through all the way through through Jesus and Muhammad. This,
and you see the Girardian themes of the unanimity of the community. They each send somebody. They all have to do it together. You know, it's the similarity of the of, you know, all 23 conspirators having to stab Caesar. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody has to be in it. The killing has to be, in a sense, unanimous to unite the community. It mm-hmm. works out with perfect Girardian logic, and mm-hmm. Girard explains this like no one I've ever read.
Yeah, and same thing with 9/11. Like, one of the reasons that I think that it's maybe not really working is that it had to have that unanimity. Like, everybody at some subliminal level maybe has to know that 9/11 was a fraud, and how could you not, at some deep level, how could you not know that it's a fraud? But they all have to sort of pretend, and everybody has to go along with the official story. But here in the truth movement, by raising our voices loudly against that, we've destroyed that unanimity.
Well, we're eroding it.
Okay.
We're eroding it. And I wouldn't say we've destroyed it. People are really of two minds about it, and they vacillate. And there's even an extent to which we can function as a kind of, I don't know, it's complex, Kevin. This is a really complex area. We could also function in a sense that phrased by Carl Muley as the comedy of innocence, that there's the unanimity of the 9/11 sacrifice has been fractured, but it hasn't crumbled. People still can't. They still revert to it. They still can't quite take themselves there. And because what it brings up is just such an ugly ramification, that we're run by a priesthood or sorcerers. And again, I'm using these terms anthropologically, not in some mystical sense. This is just a sociological analysis. We are very much like an Amerindian, you know, tribal network. Mm-hmm. We function in a way that's just so similar that anything to deny this in the face of 9/11 is just a special pleading for Western exceptionalism. And I don't want to be a part of it. I don't want to be part of that unanimity. I know you don't. We're doing our best to fracture and shatter this unanimity of the 9/11 sacrifice. But if you look at Girardian theory, this carries its own potential dangers. There's a great danger for the community that the community senses intuitively if that unanimity is successfully shattered, because then it starts the cycle of recrimination again. And this community will seek another scapegoat. I mean, this seems to be rather, you know, like a kind of automatic default mechanism. And you see this happening within the 9/11 truth movement. You see that there's one group that blames, and you know, who knows, you know, Kevin, we could, it's a whole other issue. I just want to kind of talk about it in an academic sense for a second. There's a group who blames the Zionists. There's a group who blames the Jesuits. There's, you know, everybody has, there's a group who blames the British aristocracy. You know, everybody has their favorite little bete noir, and we're all kind of prowling around each other to who's our scapegoat. Whereas I think the challenge that Girard presents, whatever the operational culpability from whatever group, is in 9/11. And there's an intelligent way, and I think, Kevin, you talk about this intelligently. And it's one reason I trust speaking with you about this, because you don't talk about it with hatred in your heart. And one of the things that we've got to look at constantly is our own place within the process of ritualization. Our own, that Catherine Bell, another really important, dearly departed ritual theorist, essential to my own work and to, you know, a contemporary understanding of ritual. And she talks about the process of ritualization. We're all a part of it. And we have to look at our own culture's role as beneficiaries of the 9/11 ritual. It does allow for the perpetuation of this very materialist and kind of fantasy culture that we're living in. Mm-hmm. You know, where it's all about the next iPhone, and the culture in one sense is really enjoyable. It offers a lot of creature comforts for that lower part of ourselves. And people may have suspicions about 9/11, but when it comes right down to it, I think they don't want to let go of, they don't listen to those suspicions because they realize it could unravel the whole darn culture. And it could bring up such terrible conflicts within our culture, to even problematize it more, if there is this Zionist connection, it could bring up a truly ugly resurgence of anti-Jewish hatred, right? Hatred of Jews, which nobody wants to see. You know, it could bring up with this Jesuit thing a hatred of Catholics that is also to a degree, you know, if you will, indigenous to American culture, being a largely Protestant.
Yeah, you know? Although I don't see that as
likely. I don't see that being so likely either. But these are the potentials that are percolating there in people's minds when they're thinking, oh, I could have 9/11 be this really simple attack by Muslims over across the sea, or it's some kind of strange, really strange conspiracy involved in the you know. In our own government, that could, if unraveling it would threaten to pull apart a fabric that of our society that seems to be, whatever its problems, at least trundling along. We're still the empire. There's a lot to lose in unraveling 9/11.
Mm-hmm. So if we stop sacrificing Muslims, then who knows who we might start sacrificing next? It might be even worse.
That, I think, is the underlying anxiety.
Yeah. And I think actually Jewish people have more of this because they're afraid that they might be the ones that get scapegoated for good reason, because actually I think there's that Zionist connection, which of course is a connection of a very, very few people that did it. And of course, 99.999% of Jews are completely innocent of anything remotely like this, just like in Hitler's Germany. It was the same situation where the whole group was targeted because of rancors and animosity that came out of a conflict with very, very few people who, you know, just a tiny number.
And even hypothetically speaking, if there is this Zionist culpability that, you know, we can suspect from things, you know, that we've talked about before, the, you know, dancing Israelis and the whole nine yards of that, you know, issue in the Mossad spy network and things like that. If there is this issue, and isn't it in some sense a mimetic response on the part of people who said enough, we're not going to take this anymore, this deep historical hatred of our people, we're going to do whatever it takes to defend our people, come hell or high water. Mm-hmm. Can't we understand this fanaticism in the light of Girard saying no one yearns to crucify like the crucified? Mm-hmm. It's not to justify it, but I think it's a mitigating circumstance that we have to take into account as we try to analyze this thing in all its difficulty and complexity.
Damn, Tom, you know, I hope that if we ever do get these 9/11 war crimes trials, that maybe you could be the lawyer for, you know, Larry Silverstein and Benjamin Netanyahu and Wolfowitz and Pearl. No, seriously, I do think we need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission here, because as you say, you know, I mean, I just did another, you know, Let's Lynch Larry Silverstein article, but you know, I kind of hate to do that, but he's asking for it. And so I, but
well,
when
and
I,
I'd, and I I don't engage in that.
It's not serious. But unfortunately, some commenters seem to take it totally seriously. It is serious. I mean, this guy is, off the, his murdering, lying chutzpah is off the charts. It's just, it's becomes black humor because it's so extreme. But that black humor, to me, is a way of getting some distance. So you don't get caught up in actually wanting to go lynch the guy.
Right. Yeah. Right. And
now put him on trial anyway, bring in Tom Breidenbach to explain why we shouldn't lynch him.
Yeah, I think we need a truth and reconciliation. That's what I'm after. And I'll do my best in defending these guys, Kevin.
I think if we could get a major big time sort of unveiling of Girardian truth, it would actually allow for some kind of real truth and reconciliation. As long as you keep the tribal hatreds going, like in South Africa, they haven't fully gotten over their past, and of course, nobody maybe ever fully has. But with 9/11, I think we have a chance, and these deep and pretty simple and obvious truths that Girard reveals have a huge role to play, I think, in saving us from the consequences of this dark period of history launched by this horrific human sacrifice on 9/11 that threatens to just keep on having these repercussions, these consequences that could take down all of humanity. We're just about at the end of the show, so give us the summary of how and why we should focus, pay attention to Girard, and what kind of role his thought will play.
Well, I think Girard, he taught in America, and America did welcome him. He taught a professor emeritus at Stanford, and he helps to articulate an underlying fairness that I think is part of the American spirit. I'm from rural Colorado, and I know, I trust the American people to be able to ultimately deal with these if we can keep getting this out. And I think Girard, who even said he had a lot of sympathy and felt even in a certain way culturally American at later on in his life, he resonates with that. He's got this very clear, of all the French theorists, he's the clearest, and he's the most accessible, and he's saying something, and it resonates with that American sense of fairness. If we can hold on to that and recover it, and as we deal with these horrible issues, he's an amazing and marvelous intellect who speaks to our common humanity. Kevin, is from you and I, from different backgrounds, are both recognizing and realizing that we are whatever our differences, brothers.
Hear, hear. Amen, brother. Or amen. That's Muslim speak for amen. And we've hit the end of the hour, but that's kind of sad because, Tom, I could sit and talk with you for hours and hours and hours. You're doing such incredible work. I'm very much looking forward to your forthcoming work, and hope you get that out soon so I can have you back to talk about it.
Great, Kevin. I look forward to it.
All right. Thanks so much, Tom.
Likewise. Bye.
Bye.
When I'm with you, I feel so small. Right in my shell, I want to crawl. Wonder why I had to fall for you. Oh, you dog. Why do you make my life so tough? It seems I can't love you half enough. You're so heavenly, much too much for me.
I wish that I were twins, you red been baby kin,
so I could love you twice as much as I do. I'd have four loving arms to embrace you, four eyes to idolize you each time I face you.
With two hearts twice and true, what couldn't four lips do?
When 4 years you sing I'm yours, you red been baby kin.
Wish that I'm a twin, so I could love you twice as much as I do. Thank you.
twin, so I can love you twice as much as I do.